Welcome. Welcome. Whoever you are, wherever you come from, whomever you love, you're welcome here, and I'm so happy to see you. This is why we have church, to come together, sit side by side, and explore life. We're all glad you're here this morning. We kindle a flame as a symbol of the Spirit that shines upon us and burns within us, and the illumination that increases when we join together with open hearts and open minds.
There is a Chinese proverb that says, when the winds of change blow, some people build walls and others build windmills. Change and the challenges it brings abounds. We have all probably heard another phrase, you can't step in the same river twice, which reminds us that change is always happening around us. Sometimes change is planned for and welcomed, as when we decide to marry or take a desired job. Or perhaps, instead, someone unexpectedly does us a favor. In these cases, we may feel a sense of grace and gratitude, and the excitement about the changes energizes us. At other times, unwanted change is foisted upon us and even may surprise us. Careful plans go awry or events out of our control happen. How do we feel at these times? How do we react? And if our initial reaction is to brace against the change, how can we move from wanting to build walls to wanting to build windmills that will harvest the winds of change? When change happens, we are rarely alone. How might we work with others from our community at times of change? How can they help us to see a new perspective? Come, let us worship together as we explore these themes of surprise, change, and community.
Into the silence, hear yourself saying yes. Saying yes to silence in community. Saying yes to noise in community when it comes our way. In this world where our feelings prove that we are human, say yes to the joys that come along. Say yes as well to the sorrows that are part of life. In a world where we and others sometimes suffer, say yes to caring enough to feel hurt and to reach out a helping hand to others. In a world where hostility arrives constantly via gossip and tweets and social media, say yes to courage and honor and honesty and staying grounded in what is real. In a life made up of all that's come before, say yes to your heritage, known, unknown, and imagined. Remembering that sometimes it is we who are in need, say yes to others who are in need. In a world of plenty, say yes to generosity, to giving, to the hand that reaches out. And when you don't have enough, say yes to reaching your own hand out. In this world of rules and dogma and limitations, say yes to each other. Say yes to yourself. Say yes to the paths that get you where you need to be. Say yes to beauty wherever it's found. The beauty of sunlight, a cool breeze, of a muggy gray day. It is all part of the beauty of life. And always, always say yes to love. Amen.
Glimpses of gentle true spirit, he runs, wishing he could fly high, only to trip at the sound of goodbye. Wordlessly watching, he waits by the window and wonders at the empty place inside. Heartlessly helping himself to her bad dreams, he worries, did he hear a goodbye? Two alone, they are three together, they are for each other. Stand by the stairway, you'll see something certain to tell you. Confusion has its cost. Love isn't lying, it's loose in a lady who lingers, saying she is lost and choking on hello. They are one person, they are two alone, they are three together, they are four.
Our reading today is from Jon Kabat-Zinn, and it's an excerpt that's titled, Wherever You Go, There You Are. Have you ever noticed that there is no running away from anything? That, sooner or later, the things you don't want to deal with and try to escape from, or paper over and pretend aren't there, catch up with you, especially if they have to do with old patterns and fears? The romantic notion is that if it's no good over here, you have to go over there and things will be different. If this job is no good, change jobs. If this wife is no good, change wives. If this town is no good, change towns. If these children are a problem, leave them for other people to look after. The underlying thinking is that the reason for your troubles is outside of you, in the location, in others, in the circumstances. Change the location, change the circumstances, and everything will fall into place. You can start over, have a new beginning. The trouble with this way of seeing is that it conveniently ignores the fact that you carry your head and your heart, and what some would call your karma, around with you. You cannot escape yourself, try as you might. And what reason, other than pure wishful thinking, would you have to suspect that things would be different or better somewhere else anyway? Sooner or later, the same problems would arise if, in fact, they stem in large part from your pattern of seeing, thinking, and behaving. Too often, our lives cease working because we cease working at life, because we are unwilling to take responsibility for things as they are and to work with our difficulties. We don't understand that it is actually possible to attain clarity, understanding, and transformation right in the middle of what is here and now, however problematic it may be. But it is easier and less threatening to our sense of self to project our involvement in our problems onto other people and the environment. It is so much easier to find fault, to blame, to believe what is needed is a change on the outside, an escape from forces that are holding you back, preventing you from growing, from finding happiness. The casualties of this way of looking at things are all over the place. Look virtually anywhere and you will find broken relationships, broken families, broken people. Wanderers with no roots, lost, going from this place to that, this job to that, this relationship to that, this idea of salvation to that, in the desperate hope that the right person, right job, right place, right book will make it all better. Or feeling isolated, unlovable, and in despair, having given up looking and even making any attempt, however misguided, to find peace. There is no successful escaping from yourself in the long run, only transformation. It doesn't matter whether you are using drugs or meditation, alcohol or Club Med, divorce, or quitting your job. There can be no resolution leading to growth until the present situation has been faced completely and you have opened to it with mindfulness, allowing the roughness of the situation itself to sand down your own rough edges. In other words, you must be willing to let life itself become your teacher. This is the path of working where you find yourself with what is found here and now. This, then, really is it. This place, this relationship, this dilemma, this job. The challenge of mindfulness is to work with the very circumstances that you find yourself in, no matter how unpleasant, how discouraging, how limited, how unending and stuck they may appear to be, and to make sure you have done everything in your power to use their energies to transform yourself before you decide to cut your losses and move on. It is right here that the real work needs to happen. If you think your meditation practice is dull or no good, or the conditions aren't right where you find yourself, and you think that if only you were in a cave in the Himalayas, or an Asian monastery, or a beach in the tropics, or at a retreat in some natural setting, things would be better, your meditation stronger, think again. When you got to your cave, or your beach, or your retreat, there you would be, with the same mind, the same body, the very same breath you already have here. About 15 minutes or so in that cave, you might get lonely, or you might want light, or the roof might drip water on you. If you were on the beach, it might be raining or cold. If you were on retreat, you might not like the teachers or the food or your room. There is always something to dislike. So why not let go and admit that you might as well be at home wherever you are. Right in that moment, you touch the core of your being and invite mindfulness to enter and heal. If you understand this, then and only then will the cave, the monastery, the beach, the retreat center offer up their true richnesses to you. But so will all the other moments and places.
I've been hearing something lately. I've been hearing this great excitement about what the search committee, the ministerial search committee, is doing, and listening to everyone's thoughts about what to look for, what will come next. And my congratulations to the search committee for energizing people. Everyone who's talked to me about it has said, it seemed like that was too long of a time to set aside, and then I got so into it, it just flew by. That's a really good sign, and it bodes well for the future for everyone's voice to be involved. There are parks in the city that, where I grew up, that line the river that flows through town. Over the last 110 years or so, it's a relatively young town compared to the Midwest, various generous people have funded the development of these parks, and each one is named for a woman who was or is a generous civic leader. And that seemed normal to me growing up. Julia Davis and Ann Morrison and so on, Catherine Albertson Park is gorgeous. It just seemed normal that wealthy men would donate land and money to create parks in tribute to their wives who'd been able to spend their lives in service to the community. The largest park was also the closest to my home, 150 acres or so, featured an impressive spray fountain in the middle. It shot up maybe 50 feet in the air, and different colors of lights would shine on it at night. And I remember watching from a distance when I was very young. I'm 2 years older than that park, so I probably went to the grand opening, although I don't recall that. The design and the money to build that park came from a world-renowned engineering firm, and it shows. There are long, straight sidewalks forming rectangles around geometrically perfect plantings with the large wading pool-type fountain in the middle, although there are warning signs all over, dangerous water, do not drink, do not touch. It's all very linear and formal, and you will almost never find anyone walking along those paths. Along the two edges of the park, there is water, the river on one side that flows all the way through town, and a series of ponds on the other, which the classic duck pond in a park. You'll almost never find anyone walking on those paths either. It's not that the park is empty. On the contrary, it's used by many. It's a busy place much of the time. It just seems that the design made by those engineers didn't factor in true human elements. It's true that the shortest distance between two points is a straight line, of course, but human behavior is not always interested in a short distance, especially if there's nothing of interest at either end of the path. Now, it's been almost 60 years since the park was developed, and people have found ways to use it in spite of its design. Sometimes you can tell by where the grass is worn off. Ah, somebody made a new path. It's evidence that people will find a way to do what they feel they need to do or to get where they want to go. When I was in high school, there was a faintly worn footpath through the grass that led to a mounded area that was speckled with trees. It was a place we could go as high schoolers and do what high schoolers do without being seen. It was an important path, it was faint, but in that geometric layout of the world, that one lumpy spot with trees was the most important to me and my friends. And I wonder often how successfully we modify or control people's behavior with the designs that we build or the rules that we set. Does our adjustment of the environment really modify people's behavior? If so, how can we design for humanity instead of without regard to humanity? Now, there is a place for straight lines. The next park upriver is much older, has many curving walkways under the giant trees, same river on one side, and it's used by many with this wide path that runs right down the middle of it. It's a boulevard, it's an avenue, it's an esplanade. I don't know what it is, but it's really wide and you could fit thousands of people on it at once. And people walk that straight path because the art museum's at one end and the zoo is at the other end. So there are places to go. And when they just want to be in the park, they take the curving walkways. When considering the shortest distance between two points, maybe we first need to find out if anyone's interested in those points. Now, there's a lot of pavement like this in the world. Concrete, asphalt, macadam, cobblestone, and simple, hard-packed earth. Sometimes it leads you to a place you want to be. But as a person inclined to make inquiry into matters of life, I wonder if we might be wise to consider, do we want to be where everyone else went? Do we mean to follow the same road we've always followed? The reading Kathy shared referred to the path of working where you find yourself with what is found here and now. This place, this relationship, this dilemma, this job. Yes, yes, this is a way of being mindful of what is, the isness of our lives, whatever that might be for us in a moment of our life. Sometimes the path of mindfulness involves staying and dealing with what is going on. Sometimes it means something else. But as I talk about paths, I talk about this, perhaps you think of Robert Frost. When I was stuck in what to say, I did too. He referred to this as a very tricky poem, and yet it's one of the best known, or at least parts of it are. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth, then took the other as just as fair and having perhaps the better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear, though as for that the passing there had warned them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Well, now, Frost said that the speaker in the poem, the I, was based on his friend Edward Thomas, saying Thomas was a person who, whichever road he took, he would regret and wish he had taken the other one. Apparently, it isn't meant to promote the benefits of free thinking. I took the road less traveled by. Oh, that's made all the difference. It's more like, and I missed something. I took the wrong road, whichever one I chose. Poor Edward Thomas was perhaps anxious. And he took it personally, and he took it seriously. So he proved he could commit to something, and he enlisted to serve in World War I and was killed shortly thereafter. Robert Frost was hurt by that, by what he had done, but he knew that poems are tricky, words are tricky, speaking and writing are risky and tricky. People take from words what they most want or need, and sometimes that's far from the meaning. Sometimes what we most need or feel like we need is to be heard. And that led, in my thinking, to when Hal told me that he and Vanessa and Blaine were working on the song we just heard. I knew I wanted it today, and even last night at 10 p.m., I didn't know why I wanted it today. People have ascribed meaning to the lyrics of that for over 50 years now. Helplessly hoping her harlequin hovers nearby, awaiting a word. Stephen Stills wrote that during a difficult breakup with Judy Collins, who was struggling with serious mental health issues at the time and addiction and behaviors that seem possibly reflected in the disconnection in that song. Wordlessly watching, he waits by the window and wonders at the empty place inside. See, harlequins are mute characters. They don't get to speak. The one in the song might be waiting to be able to speak or waiting for words from her. The paths are unclear and there's no way to connect. That's the main thing. There's no way for those two people in the song to connect. It's painful. It's difficult. And that's what I realized matters today. When I'm being successful at mindfulness, I am aware sometimes that I'm being angered or hurt by something I hear or read because that's what I need or want in the moment. This is why I don't watch the news, because I don't really want to feel angered and hurt and distraught and anxious and worried. It's hard for me to be hurt or angry. I don't like how much of life I miss when I'm in those states of mind. I don't like myself when I get stuck in those places. But sometimes it's real, and I am stuck. And I'm thinking of grief right now, and how I carry grief, and how it carries me, and how it can be crippling. Among the very big things that have happened in the last month, two are most present in my heart. I was in New Orleans watching our recent intern, Dave, receive preliminary fellowship as a Unitarian Universalist minister, along with many dozens of others. All he did was walk up on stage and sit in the back row, and dozens of others around him, all looking about the same. In the same service, the names of colleagues who have died in the last year are solemnly read. I was reminded of the passing of some dear colleagues as we went through the list, and the projected pictures of people who meant a lot to me flashed before me. At the end of the printed list, they paused and said, "Sadly, there are four more who have died since this was printed." And they added four names without pictures being projected, and one was my most beloved professor. The last person in my life I could count as a substitute father figure. Even 10 years ago, He and I talked about death. He and another dear professor, and Rick Mastin, one of whose songs we will sing later, they were buddies, and they hung out in Big Sur and in Berkeley, and they wrote death poetry. It was kind of a competitive event for them. This is what happens when you get ministers together. You do things like that. Bob said, "You know, it's surprisingly hard to get dead." That's the kind of thing Bob would say. And then after 89 years, he just got dead. Not quite what he had in mind. I was distracted for the rest of the service, and I left a few minutes before it concluded and returned to my hotel to research and confirm that it really was my Bob Kimball who had died. And of course it was. And it's fair to say that every loss brings up every loss that's come before. It's an act of mindfulness to be aware of that, and I was being mindful of the absence of dear friends. I knew that contributed to why I was feeling fragile. And that's the benefit of mindfulness. I knew why. And the second big thing that happened occurred 12 hours later, still in New Orleans. Just 12 hours after learning of Bob's death, I was at an early meeting and friends were talking about someone we all knew who had done a great harm to me many years ago. The harm he did was significant, multifaceted, and can't be undone. But I've missed the friendship we had for the 20 years prior to that. I was listening to them and just kind of lost in my feelings of loss. And one friend turned to me and said, "I'll bet he misses you too. You were a good friend." Once in a while, somebody says something new, or they say something in a new way, or I simply hear it in a new way. "I'll bet he misses you too." That was such a moment. I'd been stamping the same ground. I had been making pavement on a path where I didn't want to be, but I wasn't mindful of that until that moment. That last piece came into place, into my heart, and I said, "That's right. It wasn't just my loss." It wasn't a path of movement I had made. It was a path of stuckness, a little island, if you will, of despair. And I had these two losses in my heart as I finished my work in New Orleans and returned to Ohio. I had the kind of friendship that alters the course of a life, and the kind of man with whom I could travel through the most treacherous aspects of the human condition and return more whole than when we began. Because every loss does indeed bring up every loss that came before, I was also carrying the rest of my life, as we all do. But something was different. Some people understand grief as something with stages. My experience and training suggests that there is more to it than that, but a few stages are worth considering. They come from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who named five stages: denial and isolation, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. Those are common, but they don't go in a particular order, and more importantly, they don't take a particular amount of time. To some degree, it seems that we all go through those phases with every loss we face. Phases probably better than stages, because it's not a ladder you climb, it's not something you can graduate from. The goal, using the current meaning of these two words, is to move through grieving into mourning. Grief is what you think and feel inside when you experience a loss. It's the numbness, the sadness, the anger, the regret, all rolled into one. It's that pain in your gut. It's that hole in your chest. Mourning is expressing that grief, letting it out somehow. You mourn when you cry, when you talk about the loss, when you write about it, when you speak about it, or find a safe way to act out physically. Some people really are helped by punching a pillow, for example. It really works for some people. Not me, but for some, and that's fine. Everybody grieves inside when someone they love dies or they feel a loss, and the paths to return to normal life can disappear. People who mourn really heal and move on to live and love fully again, constantly remembering and cherishing the values their loved ones have given to them. It's a journey. It's very individual. You can't follow someone else's path or expect them to follow yours. We won't get where we need or want to be by doing that. I've been missing Bob since he retired from my seminary while I was still a student. It's about 21 years ago. He left the school in the same way a wisp of smoke leaves a candle when it's extinguished. We talked about that too. He just wanted to dissolve into the air as if he had never been there. There are theological reasons for that. I won't get into it right now. We visited a few times since then. We had great connection. He gave me a quote in calligraphy when he left, and it described and cemented our relationship. Johann Wolfgang von Goethe wrote, "The world is so empty if one thinks only of mountains, rivers, and cities. But to know someone who thinks and feels with us and who, though distant, is close to us in spirit, this makes the earth for us an inhabited garden." Well, I've carried him in my heart and spirit for over 20 years. I'm deeply saddened by the reality that we will not meet again in this life. I feel that sadness all the way into my bones. Yet I'm grateful. The tragic loss would be if I didn't care, if I was like, oh, whatever. If I was unmoved by his death, it would diminish both of our lives. We have to honor our grief. I'm not likely to find another father figure in my life. It seems natural with age. It's not likely to keep happening forever. There's something natural about accepting that, too. The loss is bittersweet, but there's a lot of sweet. Meanwhile, my old friend who harmed me is still alive, and I'm still alive, and life-defining friendships don't spring up all that frequently. I watched my mom burn bridges between herself and her friends due to much smaller offenses, destroying relationships through her own indignation over imagined slights. Oh, she was fierce. She was fervent and untrusting of others. The paths she built, she also destroyed. She may have thought she was speaking honestly about her hurts, but the evidence suggests otherwise. There wasn't much happiness for her, and by extension, for those around her. Thinking of that, I found my ex-friend and arranged to meet. "Oh, we have business to discuss," I said. Shortly into our conversation in a coffee shop, I offered an OBTW. You know what that is? I've seen that on doctor's charts. "Oh, by the way," it's that line that's usually what you're really there for. "Oh, by the way," I use that in my own notes too. It hints directly at the real reason somebody has come to see me. "Oh, by the way," I named the reality that I had lost a huge amount because of him and what he did. And one other thing was as big as all the tangible losses, and I felt it deeply, and I told him the loss of that friendship. Now, he's not known for being demonstrative with tender emotions. Far from it. He's about the opposite of that. The only times I'd seen him cry before were times we were laughing so hard it was unavoidable, because we were really good at laughing. "I've missed you too," he said. There's one mandatory aspect of making amends, of paving a path back to connectedness, and that is honesty. And there's one mandatory aspect to dealing with loss, and that is getting to a place you can mourn, whatever it takes to get there. letting ourselves pass through grief, even as grief passes through us, can lead us into mourning and therefore living a whole and complete life again, carrying the loss as something of great value and not something missing in our lives. Those are paths we would do well to create and to follow. They're paths that connect us each to each. And if God is love, as our universalist roots tell us, then we are called to live in love, to only connect, to mend that which has come apart. The common paved paths through life have rarely led me to the places I need to go. The connections modeled by my family of origin only lead to disconnection. Those paths don't go where I want or need to be. So I invite you to consider that might be true for you sometimes. There's a puzzling reality involved. We are really all in this together. This is what community is. We all end up in the same phases, various mileposts between birth and death. We all enter those same phases for a moment or a lifetime. Yet we can't do that by staying on the path taken by everybody else. If you're going to put down pavement to make your journey smoother, put it between where you are now and where you need to go. And next week, we'll do that playfully and with purpose. May it be so.
Born in the path of the winter wind and raised where the mountains are old, their springtime waters came dancing down. I remember the tales they told, the whistling ways of my younger days too quickly have faded on by, but all of their memories linger on like the light in the fading sky. River, take me along in your sunshine, sing me a song ever moving, winding and free. You changing old river, let's you and me, river, run down to the sea. I've been to the city and back again, been moved by some things that I've learned, met a lot of good people, I've called them friends, felt the change when the seasons turn. I've heard all the songs that the children sing and listened to love's melodies. I felt my own music within me rise like the wind in the autumn trees. River, take me along in your sunshine, sing me your song ever moving, winding and free. You rolling old river, you changing old river, let's you and me, river, run down to the sea. Someday when the flowers are blooming still, someday when the grass is still green, my rolling waters will round the bend and flow into the open sea. So here's to the rainbow that followed me here, and here's to the friends that I know, and here's to the song that's within me now. I will sing it wherever I go. River, take me along in your sunshine, sing me a song ever moving, winding and free. You rolling old river, you changing old river, let's you and me, river, run down to the sea.
There's a little passage printed in your order of service that we're going to read together. It's also in the hymnal. So if you ever want to know where it came from, you can reference that. But please join me in these words. Go your ways, knowing not the answers to all things, yet seeking always the answer to one more thing than you know. If nothing's wrong, then nothing's right, right? If nothing's wrong, if we aren't uncomfortable sometimes, then we're missing out. If we don't feel loss and do something with it, then we're missing out. If we think everything's just rosy and perfect all the time, then we're not fully living our lives. Oh, by the way, you can start living your life fully anytime, and you can follow any path you need to. And that's the joy of being together as Unitarian Universalists. Go in peace.